takes this seriously. Okay, we're going to proceed if we can, and this is 05AP718D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Michael R. Inglemo. Counsel representing the OLR. Thank you. Good seeing you, sir.
Good afternoon. My name is Matt Onich. I'm from Ashland. I represent the OLR in this proceeding. This is an appeal from the referee's report. The OLR's complaint contains 15 counts. The referee found violations as to 10. The OLR's appeal relates to the remaining 5 counts. Prior to the hearing in this matter, the referee had granted summary judgment to the OLR on count 9, but in his findings he, in effect, took away summary judgment. Because he granted summary judgment prior to the hearing, we really didn't present evidence at the hearing on that count. The first issue, which is the main reason for the appeal, involves 4 counts, namely counts 9, 11 as to client White, 12 and 13, in which the referee found that Mr. Inglemo did commit the criminal conduct as alleged, but they found no 8.4B violation.
Was that the marijuana?
As to those 4 counts,
yes.
Count 9 was a criminal conviction for possession of marijuana. Count 11 was the use of marijuana with a client. Count 12 was delivery of marijuana to a client. And count 13 was delivery of or use of marijuana with a client and his spouse. And as to each of those 4 counts, the referee found that the conduct occurred, but did not find the required nexus that the referee was looking for. The third issue is one of statutory interpretation, is what the word with means when it's used in section 20:1.8K2 under circumstances where an attorney with his client simultaneously has sexual relations with the client's girlfriend in a 3-person sexual encounter. The fourth and fifth issues can more or less be rolled together. The fourth issue related to count 15 of the complaint, where the referee found a violation but said no sanctions should be imposed as it was a technical violation, and count 5 is what is the appropriate sanction in this proceeding. So the first issue, which was the reason for this appeal, the OLR was concerned about the precedent being established and felt that guidance from the court may be also helpful in future cases that could involve a situation where an attorney uses a controlled substance and what nexus, if anything, that has to do with the practice of law. In the Penn case, which is cited in the brief, 8.4B was found to have been violated by Attorney Penn under circumstances where he was in a casino, a patron complained to management after seeing him snort cocaine off a counter in a restroom, and a squad car stopped the vehicle as he left the parking lot. Mr. Penn was found to have cocaine metabolites and marijuana metabolites in his system, and on that basis alone, he was found to have violated 8.4B. That occurred under circumstances where Mr. Penn was no longer practicing law, so it couldn't have had an outcome or an impact on a client of his. We've also cited in the brief the Broadnax case, where Mr. Broadnax had prior problems with controlled substances, was subject to random blood testing, or random urine testing, had a dirty test showing cocaine usage, and that was an 8.4B violation, and a more recent Peterson case, again involving the use of cocaine. Applying 8.4B to this case, the referee looked at the comments to 8.4B, and 8.4B basically talks about an attorney who commits a criminal act that reflects adversely on his honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness as a lawyer in other respects. And when the referee looked at the comment, it identified certain conducts such as fraud, willful failure to file tax returns, and said historically it related to crimes involving moral turpitude such as adultery. And the The referee saw the language that said not all offenses carry with it this adverse effect on an attorney or this adverse reflection on the attorney's fitness. And the referee basically equated this language to saying, in order for the OLR to prove these violations, we need to prove that he was deficient as an attorney or an individual client was impacted. He wanted a direct nexus between the criminal act and the adverse effect on someone. And because the OLR did not, in the referee's opinion, show that nexus, he found no violation as to these. And in count 9, this was the criminal conviction for possession of marijuana in Douglas County. The referee said there was no connection there. Count 11, the referee found that he did smoke marijuana with client White at a party where other people were present, including the other person charged in count 11. But he said there was no proof that there was incompetent legal services, so he said that didn't violate 8.4B. As to count 12, and this was the most disturbing one from my point of view, he found affirmatively that Mr. Inglimo delivered marijuana to a client, but then said there's no nexus. It doesn't show that he did a poor job in legal services or that it affected any legal services for that client. So he said that that was not an 8.4B violation. In count 13, which is the fourth of the four counts in issue 1, there was a videotape that showed Mr. Inglimo smoking marijuana with his client and his client's wife prior to him engaging in sexual intercourse with the client's wife. And the referee again said that does not reflect adversely on an attorney unless it impacts on legal services. The OLR felt this sort of conduct did reflect adversely on attorney's fitness, even if there weren't clients involved, even if it was just a layperson that he had delivered marijuana to, used marijuana with, etc. And that's the main issue in the case. The second issue relates to whether the OLR carried its burden of proof in regard to Mr. Inglimo using marijuana with Tammy Ritchie, a 16-year-old, as alleged in count 11. From the OLR's point of view, we believe that we did prove our case. Mr. Inglimo admitted it. If you look at what he admitted, paragraph 71 of the complaint, when he was asked if he did it, he took the Fifth Amendment, and an adverse inference is available here. The 16-year-old girl said it happened, and three other people that were present at this party said that this did occur. The third issue is how the word with should be interpreted in 20:1.8K2, and this is count one, where it's alleged that Mr. Inglimo had sexual relations with a client. If you look in the dictionary at with, there's various definitions available, but commonly one of the definitions for with is that it's someone's a companion, accompanied or accompanying someone. But what occurred in this instance was that Mr. Inglimo and his client, Lawrence Kempton Jr., simultaneously had sexual relations with Kempton's girlfriend, Jennifer. Jennifer was a former client, but was not then a client of Mr. Inglimo. Sexual relations is defined in there, and the admissions in the complaint and answer are that these relations occurred. The referee interpreted with one way. A question is, how broad should with be interpreted when used in this statute? One concern we had was an absurd result where an attorney could be found to violate the provision of the rule with just one person, but if a second one's involved, so it's a threesome, then it's not a violation. The fourth issue that's involved relates to count 15. This is a rule that requires an attorney who's convicted of a crime to let the OLR and the clerk of this court know within 5 days. It didn't occur here. Initially, there was an attempt to blame the attorney on the district investigative committee. Later, Mr. Inglimo now blames his own attorney. Under the Connor case cited in our brief, we believe that Mr. Inglimo is responsible for his attorney's failure, if it was a failure of his attorney, since he failed to make reasonable inquiry. We don't consider this the most serious violation, but the referee said it should be no sanction at all, and the OLR contends it should be considered. And the last issue that is the fifth one is what sanction is appropriate here. The referee, as indicated earlier, recommended no sanction for count 15, and he did not find any violation as to five other counts that we believe there are violations for. The OLR's main concern is avoiding disparate dispositions where two attorneys similarly situated are treated substantially different unless there's a proper reason for that. A practical problem in this case is trying to find another similar case, and I was unable to find one that involved the exact same sort of violations as we have here. We tried to take it into pieces and say the trust account violations, which are counts 3 through 6, together with count 7, which is the conversion of client funds. If you take those five trust account violations and the conversion of funds together, there appeared to be support for a one-year suspension. And also precedent seemed to support a one-year suspension for the six counts of 8.4B violations. That leaves the first count of sex with a client and the two conflict of interest counts, 8 and 14, involving the wives of clients. And for that, there appeared to be support in the cases we found for another 6 months suspension, putting them together and concluding that the totality of them may exceed the way I broke them down, that OLR was recommending a three-year suspension. The referee viewed things a little differently. He viewed count 2, which was an 8.4B violation that he did find a nexus for, to be very serious, and he recommended a year for that alone. The referee also found counts 8 and 14 to be serious, but as indicated in my earlier remarks on count 1, he didn't find 8.4 violations for those four that the OLR believes exist, and he didn't find one as to Tammy Ritchie, which we believe exists. With the referee recommending a full year on just one of the 8.4B violations, I don't know what he would have projected as far as a recommendation if there were six like we believe to exist. He did not, at one point the referee considered the conversion of client funds serious, and then later at the end he didn't seem to treat them as seriously, but the OLR does view the conversion of client funds to be a serious violation.
So what are you here recommending? What the OLR recommends?
The OLR is seeking a three-year suspension. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Would he deserve 3 years even if the court agreed with the referee on 9, 11, 12, 13, and I guess 15, if I got the right numbers? One.
I guess I haven't sat down and done as detailed an analysis as the referee did. He had all the kinds of different combinations and what he recommended. We believe that a three-year suspension is appropriate for if the court finds a violation for all of the counts in the complaint. That's all I have.
Thank you,
counsel.
If there's
any questions.
Mr. Inglemo, representing yourself. Pardon me? Yes. No, you have 30 minutes, counsel. Mr. Anich had 25, and he gets 5 minutes in rebuttal. You have 30 minutes, which you may or may not use if you wish.
How do you pronounce your last name, Inglemo?
Good afternoon. My name is Michael R. Inglemo. That's how I've been pronouncing it since law school. It seems like it's been easier for the clients and as well as the law school teachers. Before I begin, there was a letter that I received from Mr. Onich, and I just wanted to make one point clear. There was a statement made in my reply brief that related to a lack of disciplinary history. I wanted to make sure that the court understood that there had been previous grievances filed against me. However, none of those grievances had been found to be worthy. There was one matter that was found that I entered into an agreement with the OLR last fall, I believe, having to do with how I listed my name and being involved with the firm, and that was all taken care of. I just wanted to make that point since Mr. Onish and I had agreed that I would bring that up to your honors. I've been practicing law since I was admitted to the bar in Illinois. I took the February 85 bar exam in Chicago and passed, and then I took the July 1985 bar exam in Wisconsin and was I entered my practice in Wisconsin in September of 1985. I was then admitted by motion I believe it was 1991 in the state of Minnesota, since I live in a border county. I've practiced in states by permission, in the state of Washington, California, Oregon, Nevada, Arizona, Texas, and Mississippi, as well as Lac-Couturier Indian Reservation in Hayward and Kiwanis Bay Reservation in Lance, Northern Michigan. I have had no problems practicing throughout my 22 years other than these incidences. I run a general practice. It's just me. I ran an office for a while. I terminated that office in 1996 and began practicing without a staff and using the telephone machines and computers and practice that way. That's integral to understand to some of these claims, because when I involve myself with clients, there's many times that I meet them at the local library. I'll meet them at my home. I have an office there. I'll meet them at their home. And I ask every single one of them if that's more convenient, and I have yet to have any of them say that it's not. I don't practice big-time litigation. I do family things. And I must say that this is the most embarrassing thing that's ever occurred to me in my life, to stand here in front of the Wisconsin Supreme Court and have to answer for this. Is very embarrassing. There was a comment made in the referee's decision talking about remorse. And I wanted to address that because I didn't want to let that go by. There isn't a day that I don't wake up. There isn't a day that I go to sleep or go to work since this all began that it doesn't affect me deeply. I've discussed the matter with the clients. Everything I do is by referral. I don't list advertising. I don't list in the yellow pages. I do take cases from Wisconsin Judicare. So that's how I get my work. And I have found that I have had more clients approach me since this matter occurred, and they've all been aware of the allegations that were made. I'm not here to talk down on them. The case has been tried, and I think that four issues that I identified in my combined brief need to be addressed. I did view page 82 of 84, the page that recommends the discipline by the referee. I think that's the page that your honors should look at and refer to in regards to this matter. That's page 82. I don't take any of this lightly, not in the least. I am not trying to blame shift when I say that what I think these people did or what I think this attorney who represented me before did. The intent is not to blame shift. The most difficult part in representing yourself, especially to this august body, is trying to defend actions that I believe didn't occur and then trying to come up with some explanation for those actions that did occur. I believe that the referee put a lot of work into this. The hearing was in November of 2005. This matter has been pending since the grievances were filed by Mr. Kempton in I believe it was February or March of 2002, I'm sorry. 5 years. I put into my briefs a recommendation to this court that you should take that into consideration. I take the practice of law very seriously. The matters that I got involved with these people, these were people that I knew. Now, as my parents have told me and anybody else's parents would tell them, there's some people that you shouldn't associate with. Well, after you get associated with those people, you get what you play with, and that's what ended up to me. I'm not trying to blame shift, but I think that there are some points that this court needs to address. There's two legal issues, I believe, or actually two precedents. One is the burden of proof, which is clear and convincing evidence. The second is the clearly erroneous standard that applies to the referee, a review of the referee's decision. I looked. I didn't find any other really relevant legal matter, legal citations to put into my briefs. I didn't make a lot of legal citations in my briefs. I didn't think that it would matter. I really didn't think it would matter. You can't compare one attorney's discipline to another attorney's discipline. In general, you can, but not specifically. I'm not aware of any charts. I'm not aware of any specific, this is how we can do it. The best I've got is page 82 of the disciplinary recommendation by the referee. So that's how I'm going to present it. The referee believed that the serious violations make the difference in this case. Counts 2, 8, and 14. Count 14 involves behavior that I would not repeat, but happened. It involved a videotape, actually two videotapes. One videotape that was made surreptitiously. The client brought me out, and I smoked marijuana with him, and I suffered a conviction for possession of marijuana. And a year of probation, and everybody sort of poo-poos that a little bit, but a year of probation to an attorney is an incredible sanction. At least to me it was. I was placed on probation. I had to do things. I had to do things that I had advised clients that they have to do when they walk into a courtroom. And my practice is not greatly criminal law. But one of the provisions of that probation was an AODA assessment, which goes along with every possession of controlled substance or driving under the influence charge. I got a flyer. I called the Wisconsin Bar. They referred me to, they said that I could get another attorney that I could talk to, the lawyers for lawyers. I thought that was nice. I got a flyer from the state of Minnesota of an incredible program that was sponsored by the Supreme Court of the state of Minnesota. I wouldn't belabor the point, but I think that it was extremely helpful. The state of Minnesota contracted with an independent organization. Their report was attached to, they were called Team Inc., T-E-A-M, Inc. They do assessments. They have psychologists on staff. They got together with the state of Minnesota, and they ran a group therapy program, an incredible program. Every Wednesday, I drove the 2.5 hours from Foxborough, Wisconsin, down to the Twin Cities, and met with anywhere from 5 to 8 attorneys. An incredible program that allowed me to get some of the 20 years of frustration and secrets and all the rest of that out in a group of other attorneys to deal with these problems that had occurred over those couple of years. And I must say, it was an incredible program and it did me a lot. The assessment to enter into that program was about an hour with a young woman, and she misstated a number of things that I had said. I came up with an AOD assessment. They referred me to the director of the program. It's in the testimony where I say that I dealt with this man because he said, I think maybe you need inpatient, based on what this woman was saying. I talked to him. He said, well, I explained to him what the corrections should be. He said that, well, why don't you come to the program every week? And if you agree to take whatever steps I tell you to take, Then I'll let you in the program. I'll let you stay. I was in that program for a year, and it consisted of weekly meetings. I then got another AODSA assessment, again, pursuant to probation. I don't want to take up all my time doing this, but I just wanted to make the point. The second AODA assessment was done locally. I testified that there were a number of written tests that I took. The problem that came up was that although those recommendations came into evidence, the director of the program who did the assessment, although he was subpoenaed, was never forced to testify in court. And that I have no excuse for, I guess. I can't just rely on my attorney, but I had hired somebody to do that. For some reason, he made the decision, and that person didn't testify. I believe that the competency of an attorney, especially an attorney involved with controlled substances or drinking or any of those things, is an ongoing process. And I don't think that it just stops at one point. And I don't think that you can just say, well, he didn't bring enough information in, we should just drop the matter. We should just leave it at where it was. I have no problem. I signed releases the day I walked into both of those programs. I have no problem with the court or anybody else doing the investigation to find that information to see where I'm at. I'm assuming, based on the referee's recommendation, that if there was to be discipline assessed, that I would be required to do things as a part of that.
Where do you think you are at?
Where am I, ma'am? I believe that at this point, I have been through the ringer. I haven't touched any controlled substances since this whole mess started. I don't intend on doing any more of that. That was a brief period in my life. I've been through everything in my life in the last 5 years. I have come out the other side. I have represented people in 3 states, in many, many counties. I have tried cases. I have met with people. I have practiced law for the past 5 years. And I believe I've come over and proven myself to be able to be fit to practice law.
You should think you should have any discipline imposed?
I believe there should be discipline, Your Honor.
What do you think it should be?
I think that discipline should involve supervision of the court, of another attorney, of some sort of oversight to make sure that I am not going to go back into position where I'm abusing any of those substances.
Are you familiar with the compendium that we look at from time to time, which maybe Mr. Anich, your opposing counsel, may be used? Are you familiar that we have looked at other cases of people that have used drugs or delivered drugs or had trust account violations? Are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not, Your Honor.
Okay. So as I see in your brief, you're saying that you don't disagree with the discipline that's been recommended. Your recommendation, as I understand it, based on Justice Bradley's question, is that you think that it should be some type of supervision with another attorney reviewing your work or working with you. How would that work out?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's based on my disagreement with 3 points of the court, of the referee's decision, the one being that I was under the influence of controlled substances when I tried a jury trial in Douglas County, which I completely disagree with, and I believe that they have found no evidence of that.
Which count was that again?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Which count
Douglas
was that
County.
Again? Which count?
That would be count 2.
What was you mentioned the possession of THC. Was there also, just so I understand, was there a conviction for delivery? Was there a conviction for delivery, or was that dropped?
There was no conviction for delivery of a controlled substance, Your Honor. There was a 3-count complaint
right.
filed against me. One count was for possession of cocaine, one for possession of marijuana, and the third was a felony count. Those 2 counts were dropped, and the possession of marijuana count was the one that was done. And I wanted to make sure that this court understood that the only evidence that this court based its decision on this trial was this comment on page 145 of the transcript where the attorney, Mr. Kempton makes a comment, and he says, in answer to a question, well, his eyes were dilated, you know. He was, the things we talked about the week before or 2 weeks before, he didn't even bring up a trial, you know. That's on page 144 of the transcript. He further said that he believed that I was disorganized, and that wasn't true. And the basis in my brief that comes up, Your Honor, is that they claim that we didn't introduce the file. And I wanted to make sure that this Court understood that that file, along with the Swanger file, was in the hands of the OLR for from May of 2004 to June or July of 2005. And I'm not here to bang on them, because they work really hard, and this is a really hard case to deal with. And they have to be in a prosecutorial mode. I understand that. But I can't think that this Court should allow the fact that they've looked at all of the notes, and I have them with me, if you want to look at them again, of the preparation date, of the 2 days of trial. They introduced one comment by this guy, and nobody asks the judge, nobody asks the jury or the cops that were there or the prosecutor or anybody else. It would offend me if I walked into court and the other attorney was under the influence. I would make a comment. But to say that just because this one guy said this, that I should suffer a year of suspension for something I didn't do, I have to defend myself against that. But if reviewing my work is what's going to make the difference, if another attorney or if I have to report to somebody or somebody's going to look at my work, I would welcome that. As a sole practitioner, having other attorneys that you can deal with that can look at your work is always helpful. But if you want to have some sort of record that I'm not using, I haven't used anything in 5 years. I wasn't into all of these various drugs that have been bandied about. This got involved because I got involved with the wrong people. Those people are out of my life. And once those people went out of my life, a review of my work at that point would disclose I took fewer cases, I actually made more consistent fees, and I got more work done. The other point about the Swanger case, there was a point made about emails that I didn't save at the time. I dealt with a client who was unrepresented on the other side. This client, I met her at the library. I gave her every, when you're talking to somebody else, I gave her every respect of not trying to talk down to her. She's an intelligent woman. Somehow, those meetings got twisted around that I was establishing a social relationship with this woman. Now, I regret that later on, after the case was over, that there was an event that got involved, that I got involved in. And it was regrettable, but it had to do with that summer. But I didn't take a client's trust and throw it out the window and misrepresent him and turn around and start representing the other side and cut him a bad deal. That didn't happen. And the last part, there's been some... Again, we're talking about clear and convincing evidence burden and clearly erroneous. There were some statements made, as I started to say, in a couple of videotapes. I believe the referee has misstated the evidence in that there was confusion between the videotape that ended up convicting me and this other videotape that was made amongst myself, Mr. and Mrs. Castern. And at the time, I want to make it very clear that there's very conflicting evidence. I wasn't representing Kim Castern at the time.
What's on the tape is on the tape, right?
Exactly.
That's not conflicting, is it?
Exactly. And the tape is broken up, and three-quarters of the tape is pictures of, is videotape of Mr. Castern filming his wife. Now, I'm not here to justify conduct. I'm here to make sure that this Court understands that there's three instances where information needs to get to this Court. And if it wasn't presented at the time of the trial, it shouldn't be held against me as much as it should be held in the idea of the burden of proof on the part of the OLR. And again, I'm not trying to get down on them. They went through this a great deal. The trust account, I did want to make a comment on that, that I did open a new trust account. I put together a spreadsheet to make sure that I've got all of the accounts cleared and that all of that is taken care of. The first trust account, which I held for many years, I did not convert client funds, but there were funds that I put in there to make sure that those funds were safe. And also, I got a letter from the Supreme Court saying the attorney needs to sign off. And again, I know this is not the trial court, but I got a letter saying that the attorney has to be responsible if there's any overdrafts. I can't imagine how there could be an overdraft in a trust account since it's a zero-sum account. However, to make sure that there wasn't, I made sure that there was money in there. Not so that I could use all the time, but so that there was money in there in case there was an overdraft. They went through the records. I gave them, and this is the final point that I want to make. I gave them everything that they asked for. I don't want this court to believe that I withheld evidence or withheld files or withheld anything from the OLR. I gave them evidence of every single transaction during the period that they wanted. I kept books of recording every transaction in and every transaction out. Maybe that isn't completely compliant with the rule, and I understand that now. But I did give them that evidence. I gave them the files that they asked for. I brought in 3, maybe 4 boxes. I'm not quite sure how many. This size, legal size.
Are you charged with not, in those counts 3 to 7 regarding trust accounts, with failure to cooperate? I didn't think you were, but maybe I missed that.
Actually, it's not in the counts, but it's sort of insinuated when it says that I didn't provide information, that I didn't provide files at the time of the hearing. I would have brought the files. The attorney didn't ask me to bring the files. Oh, and there was one other point that, you know, there may be an objection that it wasn't brought up in the brief, but on that point, I reviewed the transcript, and when the questions were asked of Mr. Kempton as to that trial, I think that that should be looked at also on page, when Mr. Kempton began testifying, and that's on page 133.
Are you talking about count 2 now, or what are you talking
about? I'm talking about count 2. During the depositions, during my statement to the committee, I looked through it. I couldn't even find anything about Mr. Kempton. My deposition, Mr. Onish asked a number of questions about Mr. Kempton, and my attorney objected, saying that they'd already been the subject of summary judgment. When we got to the hearing, and Mr. Kempton came up on the stand after Mr. Swanger, Mr. Kempton, there was a discussion between the attorneys, and there was an objection filed. There was an objection stated, and maybe that's back a couple. Yeah, it's about page 133. There was a discussion between the attorneys. I think that my attorney believed that the Kempton matter was taken care of through summary judgment. However, the files were there. I did a trial. I did the trial, and he lost. I wanted to make that point. Again, no, it's not in the complaint, but I just wanted to make sure that you understood that I cooperated. But if I do make an impact today, I would just say that these matters came out of this type of behavior. This behavior was created by these people and those substances. And it hasn't, that situation has been put to rest, and I've proven that over the last 5 years. And I would just also like to recommend to this court that there should be a couple of more steps taken for attorneys that are in that position. And the Minnesota program was a terrific program, and maybe, you know, there's money involved, but the group therapy amongst lawyers who are out there and don't have you know, a bunch of people in their office in a 50 or 100 lawyer firm, or even a 10 lawyer firm. I think lawyers need to talk. They need to get some of these secrets off their back. They need to get some consideration going, some talking, and to get rid of some of these pressures that they have on them. And that's my recommendation, or that's my position. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you, Mr. Amish.
Mr. Nguimo is correct that the OLR did have his files for a considerable period of time. The files were returned to him prior to the hearing, and he had them. What he's referring to is a referee on a couple occasions said that he disagreed with the testimony of some of the people, but he didn't back anything up, and the referee made an observation that why didn't he put some of this information out of his files into the record?
Counsel, I have a question about count two.
Yes.
Mr. Nguimo has argued in his brief, and I think I just put it away, that the real only evidence that was given in count two is Mr. Kempton indicating that his eyes were dilated as documentation that he had been high during the course of the trial. I understand that the referee made a finding that he had, with respect to this count, but my question is there anything else in the record to support the referee's finding with respect to count two?
And I'm sorry, the point the referee made was?
I'm just taking from Mr. Anglimo's brief on page four. The referee erred in findings regarding count two. Anglimo was not, quote, high at the time of the trial. This is the trial that Kempton was involved with. Kempton's testimony that Anglimo's eyes were dilated presents no proof. There is no proof that Anglimo, and then he goes on to the reference. Was there anything else to suggest that he had been using marijuana during the course of the trial?
Maybe I can clarify things, and I understand the reason for the confusion. Count 2 simply alleges an 8.4B violation, alleges he used marijuana with a client. That's as simple as it was, and we were granted summary judgment on count 2, where generally the referee was not giving us count or summary judgment on these drug counts unless there was a connection. But the evidence that we presented was that Mr. Nguimo was in court with Lawrence Kempton, Jr., who's charged with felony theft. Judge Lucci set his bail, condition of bail, you can't possess or use a controlled substance. Mr. Kempton signed the bail bond, then he went out and used cocaine and marijuana with Mr. Nguimo, and the referee found that when you're using cocaine and marijuana with a client, you know he's out on bail, a condition of bail is he's not supposed to do it. You're not only aiding and abetting and the bail jumping and committing the drug offense, that was contrary to the court's order, and he said there's enough of a connection there, and he found a violation of count two. Now, all this other evidence.
So there was additional evidence that he had used marijuana with the client. It wasn't just coming to court with his eyes dilated.
Yes.
Thank you.
He is right. And he is right, Mr. Nguimo, that the referee granted the OLR summary judgment on count two. And the only reason I had Mr. Kempton even come to the hearing was we had a 45-minute telephone conversation on summary judgment. I think you have the transcript. The referee was struggling with this language in the comment on 8.4, and he said, I want background information. Does this guy, is he an addict and who's refused treatment? He wanted all this evidence. I put Mr. Kempton on. All the stuff that he talked about his whole trial, there is no charge here for that. It isn't like he was found guilty or something for that. That was simply background information. There's not a single thing in the complaint that relates to him doing a bad job at the guy's trial. He already had summary judgment on count two.
There wasn't a single what at the complaint? I didn't hear that. There wasn't a single allegation in the complaint as to doing a bad job at the trial? Is that what you're...
No allegation in the complaint at all. Then he raised the issue of Swanger, which is count eight of the complaint, and it's issue five in his cross appeal. I think this Swanger is about as clear a case as you're going to get of a conflict of interest where an attorney has an interest in the wife on the other side when you're representing the husband. The husband's father was a good friend of Mike Nguimo's, and Mike Swanger was very favorably disposed towards Mike Nguimo, but he'd come back to town when he's driving truck and he'd hear stories about what's going on between Mr. Nguimo and his client, and he got upset. And it's true, he met her at the library, and he didn't communicate very much with Mr. Swanger at all. But what started to get him, he found out he went to a party at his wife's house. And when I asked Mr. Anglimo at the hearing, was there controlled substances used? He went there with Tracy Porter, who's like one of the best friends of the wife on the other side of the divorce, and he takes the Fifth Amendment. He's over at the wife's house within, now I think he got fired by Mike Swanger on August 7th, and he got arrested later in August in the 20s, but he says it's in the meantime. The exact date I don't know, but he's involved in another sexual threesome with Swanger's wife, this Tracy Porter, after Swanger fires him or before. And Swanger's still married to the woman, and his lawyer's out having sex with her when he's fired the guy. And he admits that she'd come to his house at night, and he says only because it was night. That was the reason. There's testimony from Paul Castern and his wife, who were living in a camper behind Mr. Anglimo's trailer, that him and his wife were in there watching TV like 10 or 11 at night, whatever time it was. Mr. Anglimo showed up with Kat Swanger. This is when the divorce is going on. They go into his bedroom, shut the door, and they don't see him again until the next morning when she's out there with a towel around her, and allegedly Mr. Anglimo pulls the towel off her. And then they smoked marijuana and had coffee and this stuff. But I think Mike Swanger had exactly right. Mr. Anglimo was more interested in Swanger's wife than he was representing him. And Swanger ends up firing the guy and then not having a lawyer for his divorce. He acts like he had to have all these meetings with her. These people have been separated for a couple years. He had a short-term marriage, no kids, no real estate, no maintenance. I mean, there's almost no issues at all in this divorce. I think it's about the best conflict of interest case you're ever going to find. And according to Paul Castern, who heard one side of a telephone conversation, when he hears Mr. Swanger going on about how he's getting screwed and everything like this, that allegedly Mr. Anglimo said, well, this is a worthwhile trade. I get to have threesomes with his wife and in exchange for losing the client. Count 14, which is issue 6 of the cross appeal, he makes an issue about the referee finding that Kim Castern was his client at the time. He had admitted that he did work for both of the Casterns, but the issue is irrelevant. Count 14, the referee correctly found that Paul Castern was the client. Whether Kim was a client or not is irrelevant. It doesn't need to be the case. It's true the referee found she was. It's mere surplusage.
What's the count involving the definition of with?
That's count one.
Do you think that...
That's strictly statutory interpretation. Mm-hmm. I understand where the referee's coming from. We're concerned about absurdities and the way it might be interpreted, but, you know, that's something that you folks do all the time. And
absurdities. Interpreting the statute, that's right. That seemed a bit of a stretch to me, that the sexual relations with a client, I mean, I would normally think that to be sexual relations, not just with client being in the vicinity.
Well, it isn't really vicinity. It's two guys at the same time on one gal is what we're talking about.
Proximity.
Menage a trois, that's what it is. It's
okay.
Pretty close to the same.
I'll withdraw my question then.
Don't ask.
Strike that.
It is confusing. There are two videotapes. One is the cocaine videotape on, I think it's count 10, and the other one is a sex videotape. I never got to see them. Some members of the District 11 thing saw the tapes. Mr. Anglimo's criminal case was disposed of. The OLR got involved, and the tapes were destroyed already. And that's what got
both tapes? Both tapes are gone?
Both tapes got destroyed, as I understand it. The police department said they had discarded them.
Are there any other questions for Ms. Anish?
There's some things people shouldn't put on videotape. But nothing further.
OLR discipline cases of lawyers are always very difficult for OLR, and they're difficult for the lawyer who's been charged. And the court understands that. the court is appreciative of Mr. Anish's representation today, and we are appreciative of your appearing and your representing yourself and giving the court your side of this case. We understand how difficult that is to represent yourself in any case, but especially in this kind of a matter. The court will take this under advisement. So ends the hearing in 05AP0718D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Ibraman. Thank you. The court has now completed its oral arguments for this term, barring something unforeseen. Thank you.